Hello, nerds, and welcome to a special spooky edition of the Engadget podcast. It is Halloween weekend-ish, right?
Sure.
I am your host, Terrence O'Brien. Joining me this week is Devendra Hardwar, senior editor in charge of...
Zombie reanimation.
That works.
I'm dead right now.
Yeah, that works for me.
Yeah.
And also joining me, editor in charge of distributing candy corn to reporters who missed their deadline, Dana Woolman.
Oh, yeah. If you missed your deadline, you get candy corn.
Yeah.
And, like, a penny for your UNICEF box.
candy corn thrown at you, though.
If I'd like you, I'll give you mini Twix.
I could go for some mini Twix right now.
Yeah.
Well, candy to start my day. That's breakfast of champions, right?
Yes. Candy and coffee.
Candy and coffee. So how you guys doing?
Doing okay. It's been a lot of news this week.
I'm great. I was telling Terrence, I slept 9 hours last night.
Oh, wow.
So I'm feeling great.
Okay.
But you had a busy day yesterday.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
A lot of fun stuff.
We'll get into that a little bit later. It is Thursday morning when we're recording this.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time this goes up, there will have been a big Apple event.
Mm-hmm.
And there will be some news from that, which we clearly don't know at this moment in time. Yesterday was a big Microsoft event. This morning was Twitter earnings, which we're going to dig into a little bit later. It's just been a crazy, crazy week.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully Dana doesn't have to throw candy corn at anybody.
Don't get me started.
No. Do we want to jump right into it?
Sure.
And start things as we do every week with Flame Wars. You guys know how this works. You're going to debate the biggest stories of the week. You get 20 seconds to make your opening statement. If you go over your time, I give you one of these. I'll allow you time for a brief rebuttal. At the end of that, I will decide who has the stronger argument and award you 1 point. We're going to do a thing at CES on stage live to punish the loser and...
Oh. Okay.
Reward the winner. And then we'll start this whole thing over again.
That's just going to CES. That's the punishment.
But yeah, actually, the punishment is we send you to CES to cover it all by yourself.
I've done that, so that's fun.
Yeah, so have I.
It's not great.
One of the worst things to ever have to do. Let's start with Apple. Again, this will probably be confirmed by the time this podcast goes live. But right now, as of this recording, we do not know for sure whether or not this is true, but...
Except Apple leaked it itself.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's in their own documents, yeah.
That's what I'm saying. It's probably going to happen, but it looks like the new MacBooks are not going to have an escape key. I'm going to hold back on my opinion on this, but Apple just loves to get rid of things sometimes.
Yeah. But there will be that OLED touch bar, potentially, right?
So... I guess kind of my question is this the sort of thing that's like essential that Apple's going to get a lot of blowback for, or is the escape key an obsolete thing that probably needs to die, much like the caps lock key should? Dana, you can go first.
So I'm preemptively annoyed by this whole magic toolbar thing in general, but the escape key, getting rid of it, I think is an act of hubris. I think it sucks for programmers, and I think it sucks for really anyone who considers themselves a keyboard power user. And there are some people out there. Don't mess with their setup that they use all day, every day.
In right under the wire, Devendra?
Yeah, that escape key doesn't really do much, though, even for programmers. And Apple is adding, potentially, what we're hearing, this OLED strip above the keys. And you could easily put an escape key there or a cancel key or something temporary there for full screen video.
You'll never
buzz me, Terrence.
I don't even know why I let you do this segment, Devendra. Let me go back to you real quick then.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to throw it out there that I am currently using an X1 Carbon from Lenovo, which it doesn't have an OLED strip, but it has one of these like magic key strip things that does a whole
context
bunch
aware
of
strips.
Yeah. And as much as I love my ThinkPads and I love this laptop, that thing is garbage. why should I believe that Apple would do a better job with this?
I mean, just in general, Apple, their whole thing is taking ideas that have already been tried and kind of refining them. Honestly, I'm not too excited about the OLED strip either. It's just I'm surprised by the pushback against removing the escape key. Compared to like removing the headphone jack, which is a fundamental feature for many people.
Dana?
I think I'm also, it's there's we're talking about the usefulness of the escape key, but I'm also just annoyed by Apple's hubris. This is a standard American layout QWERTY keyboard. Who is Apple to mess with it? I'm annoyed by its hubris here as much as I am the removal of a classic long-standing key.
I'm a little more open to changes. Like, I've been a big fan of Microsoft's natural keyboards for a while. Those have this like split decision, and that has saved my hands from all sorts of carpal tunnel injuries. So I'm fine with people.
But like Microsoft didn't take a button away or like move the Q to the right side of the keyboard.
Yeah, but you use the Q. You never use the escape key.
I don't know.
Sometimes.
I use it fairly frequently.
For what? You just want to escape life, Terrence. It doesn't work that way, okay?
I definitely do. I do get frustrated occasionally and just slam the escape key in hopes that it gets me out of my day. But I mean, just even something simple, like if I'm watching a video on YouTube and I want to exit out of
contextually aware OLED script cancel button.
Yeah, boom. See, here's the thing is, I don't know that I trust that contextually aware
thing. It'll be in the same spot as the escape
key. Okay, so, but, so then the operating system needs to be contextually aware for a variety of different media plugins, a variety of different browsers. It has to know when sites and all that. Like, it sounds like the sort of thing that's going to be so reliant on developers and websites and all these other services to do the work for Apple. Which always seems like a bad idea to put the that brunt on somebody else.
Although it's probably not that difficult to just detect when video is being played, even if it's from like within a web browser or something.
Dania, do you have any last?
Yeah, I mean, so I would probably be slightly less annoyed about all this if Apple hadn't dragged its feet on updating the MacBook Pros in the first place. Yeah. But there are people who've been holding off on upgrading for a long time, and now their ability to get a new MacBook Pro with fresh technology and the most up-to-date technology hinges on their willingness to change their habits, which is annoying. Right. I think I'd feel a little less annoyed if they had already refreshed it and people who just wanted faster performance or longer battery life could have done it already. It does sort of feel like, I don't know what verb I'm looking for here. I don't want to say shoehorning, but...
Well, it's the opposite of shoehorning, right? Because it's just kind of, it's retracting.
that makes no sense.
Yeah, I don't know. Not surprisingly, I'm going to give this one to Dana, but I do want to explain real quick that this is less to do with specifically, I think, for me at least in terms of this argument, less about the escape key specifically, and more I think about the point that she made about this standard layout, and this is pretty universal and pretty used, and I'm going to go back to the example I have in front of me of this Lenovo X1 Carbon that I love/loathe, because it has one major difference on the keyboard. Well, it has two differences. Mm-hmm. That this did get rid of the caps lock key, and instead you have to double tap shift to caps lock.
Oh, wow.
Which I do constantly accident.
That's also,
instead of the backspace key
being... Wait, so that's why sometimes when you IM me, it's accidentally in all caps?
Yeah.
And I think you're shouting at me? Yep.
Sometimes.
That makes so much sense now.
And then the top right key, instead of being the backspace key, is the delete key. Huh. So it's like these small little tweaks... Yeah. Really throw everything off.
Like, that's understandably problematic.
Yeah.
The escape key is like, you know, having a cut on your pinky finger. It's annoying, and maybe you'll get used to it eventually.
I mean, I also think back to when I moved over to a MacBook for the first time, and I didn't have a home and an end key, and I went, what is this world that I've suddenly moved into? I don't know how this works.
Right.
It seems like the sort of thing that... I don't know why you would do it. Like, it just doesn't seem to make much sense. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it's not going to be the end of the world, but it's going to piss people off for no good reason, it seems.
Well, what is... I mean, at some point, we will have to rethink these keyboards, right, and how we use them. And what do these things mean? What does escape mean? What does tab mean? What does shift mean?
Don't get me wrong. Yeah. The entire keyboard is an anachronism at this point, basically. Like, none of these keys make any sense.
The only reason we have QWERTY is because of typewriter style, right?
And
getting those arms in place. So at some point, all this has to be rethought. Maybe we'll just like lose one key a year from Apple.
I think the larger issue is Apple habitually telling people that their current habits are bad and that you're doing it wrong and that you should do it their way.
Yeah,
and their way is the right way.
But you're
holding
it
wrong.
I think that
the headphone jack.
You're escaping it wrong.
Yeah, I like. I'm still more annoyed by the headphone jack than any of this stuff.
I mean, I think that's understandable. I am also more annoyed by the headphone jack. Yeah. Let's move on to our second topic, though. We didn't really get to talk about this last week, and I feel like we need to. Mm-hmm. Nintendo announced a new console.
Yeah.
We kind of blew by it because I think they were in.
It was in the morning.
Yeah, they were announcing it while we were recording the podcast last week. So the Nintendo Switch, which is a combo home console slash portable console. Mm-hmm. And Devendra, you wrote this piece, right? About how the best Nintendo is a desperate Nintendo.
Yes. Yeah.
So I want to give you an opportunity to talk about why people should be excited about the Nintendo Switch, and this is going to be a great console.
Mainly because it's Nintendo doing something different in a way, just like they did with the original Wii and even some of their older consoles, right? They're not playing the same game as everybody else, and combining their strength in portable with like a decent amount of power, not the same as desktop power, but you know, it's I think that'll be exciting. It'll be a different way to do consoles.
Dana?
I'm not even going to argue with the innovativeness, the uniqueness of it, but I do question whether it will be the best of both worlds. You can't pack as much hardware into the console itself, but it doesn't, from the photos, it doesn't look like it will be as comfortable to use as a truly portable or truly mobile console. So I have questions about that.
Both keeping it real tight
today. No buzzer for you.
I know.
There you go.
So... one of the things, I guess, do we know the size of the screen, Devendra?
I don't, you know, we don't have any exact specs. The screen looks like it's about 7 inches because it looks very similar to the Wii U gamepad. So I'd assume 7 inches, yeah.
So question there is, do you own a Wii U?
Yes.
And that control tablet, what are the ergonomics on that?
Like is it not good, but the control tablet is a huge thing. It has like big curves. There's a lot of bezel around it. It looks like a Fisher-Price toy. Mm. I kind of love it for Mario Maker and playing things away from the TV. But my thing with the Wii U is that I want that. I want the ability to take the game away from the TV and just like walk to the bedroom or walk outside and keep playing my game. And that's exactly what they're doubling down on with the Switch. You know, they're kind of moving back from some of the other ideas, like having a second screen. That was the big sell with the Wii U, and nothing really took advantage of it other than maybe Mario, Mario Maker.
I mean, Dan, doesn't the versatility of this do anything for you? I mean, I know you're not a gamer.
You know, it sort of does, but also I think one of the biggest things Nintendo has going for it is the social aspect. People's... the thrill of gathering around a Nintendo and playing certain classic party games. It's not really a party if you wander off into the bedroom by yourself.
No, but this is, I mean, so the thrill, what they're doing is taking that thrill and letting you have it anywhere. Because you can take this, you know, tiny console, pull off the controllers and give one to your friend and you'll be playing Mario Kart like in the park or on the bus or something. Okay. So it's taking that living room experience anywhere, which I think I'll love.
So I have two questions about that. For those who haven't seen the promotional video, reveal video for the Switch, you should go watch it.
It's 3 minutes long. Yeah.
it's not particularly long, but there's several scenes towards the end especially where they seem to be playing up this social aspect. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a whole lot of stuff around the 3DS and the DS original where you could, like, connect with other people. The Wii and the Wii U are very much built around this idea of party games. I mean, like Mario Party, I've spent so much of my high school years playing Mario Party that it's shameful. But this seems a little bit different because you aren't gathering around a TV. You're gathering around what essentially is a 7-inch tablet.
A tiny screen, yeah.
And trading back and forth these tiny little controllers that are like, I don't even... They look tiny. They look super cramped.
They look like miniature NES controllers with like the maybe directional pad and two buttons to select. The ergonomics, we'll have to see how that works out. But I love this idea, right, of like local multiplayer. You can also bring two Switches and have them like back-to-back and play a game. So that'll be four people playing on two separate consoles. Mm-hmm. That sort of thing seems pretty cool if they can actually make it work.
Four-player split screen on a 7-inch tablet?
No. Well, two players on one, two players on the other, and then kind of playing a game across both.
So I guess my last question for you, Dana, is a lot of people seem to think that we're coming to the end of home consoles as we know them anyway. is this just kind of Nintendo getting out ahead of the curve as, like, mobile gaming grows, especially, like, casual gaming on the phone? And we've seen the first, like, non-standard jump in, like, console generations.
This is a,
like,
half-step jump.
Yeah, which has never really happened before.
Mm-hmm. Happened before for Nintendo, you mean?
For consoles in general. Mm-hmm. So, like, you know...
We're seeing plenty of half-steps now, aren't we?
Well, we are now is what I'm saying, is... We've already seen some disruption in the way the console market works, and we've seen this increased move towards mobile and towards sort of a more uniform way of doing things. Mm-hmm. Is this just Nintendo kind of getting out ahead of the curve and going, like, you know what the next barrier to breakdown is? The difference between consoles and mobile.
It could well be, especially the push toward casual gaming, and this is a point that I do agree with Devendra on from his piece, which is that it could potentially be Nintendo learning from its mistakes. And I think one of its biggest mistakes in recent years was missing the boat on mobile. Mm-hmm. It's trying to catch up now, mm-hmm. but this would mark a different and maybe better approach for Nintendo if it could be a little more experimental and I don't want to say on trend, but aware of how the market is changing.
They're always experimental, but those experiments don't work mm-hmm. all the time, right? The GamePad, the Wii U thing, was like a play towards tablet gaming, but they lost out on what makes tablets so useful for gaming is that you could take it anywhere. You could be in a car and play like a game on a big screen, and that was always the big appeal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, not second screen stuff.
Yeah. I am going to give this point to Devendra. I do think that if nothing else, Nintendo had to try something new and radical at this point to keep themselves relevant. And they're doing that. Whether or not it works is something else, but we'll see.
Based on the responses I've seen on Twitter, like, people are super excited about this. But I've also been in a lot of arguments with, like, Silicon Valley people who are like, well, Nintendo should just go all in on, like, the iPhone platform and just make games for that. And that, to me, seems like Nintendo's selling its soul completely. So I never want to see that happen.
Yeah, because that worked so well for Sega.
Yeah, exactly. And remember them?
And now I want to move on to our last topic of the week. I did this one just for you, Devendra. This is my special gift to you.
Oh, man.
So Netflix showed their first trailer for their resurrected Gilmore Girls series this week. And I basically have two questions here that I want to get to. A, do we really need to bring back Gilmore Girls specifically?
Yes, we do.
Hold up, buddy. And two, isn't it time for Netflix to kind of move on and stop resurrecting shows as a matter of business at this point? I can, I guess, I'll let you guys discuss this and obviously make your points. But this, it was something when they did it at first, it seemed to make sense, and now they've continued it, and they seem pretty unique in that respect. Devendra, I will give you the first shot to defend the Gilmore Girls.
Well, first of all, the Gilmore Girls is a fantastic show. And as soon as it was put on Netflix, I saw it like just rise in popularity. My wife, I showed it to. She got through the whole series in like 2 weeks.
Wait, that's six seasons. Yes. I'm going to pause your timer. You showed it to your wife?
Yes. I'm breaking gender norms left and right, Terrence.
Continue. But
the show is great. The show is fantastic. So it makes sense for Netflix to like really invest on one of its most popular series.
I got to buzz Devendra. I got to buzz you over the Gilmore Girls.
Yeah,
it feels good.
Great,
Dana.
Gilmore Girls. I'm not a fan. I think it's overrated. It's certainly no Felicity. It's no Dawson's
Creek. I like Felicity too.
But Netflix keeps, they need to just do something more original for their originals than bring back old shows. It doesn't, hey, you're on my team.
Yeah, I know, you still ran out of time, and now we can deteriorate.
System is rigged.
Sure.
System is rigged. It's rigged against you, Dana.
Yes.
Actually, to be clear, it's rigged against Devendra. I've already marked the point down for Dana.
Yeah, this is all a losing battle. But Gilmore Girls is fantastic. The show, I mean, yeah, later seasons, not so much. Same with Felicity, by the way.
So we agree on that. Okay.
And
I really do like that show, but I said it mostly to mess with you.
Yeah, you won't mess with me because I like Felicity. Okay. And also gave us J.J. Abrams, who's now doing Star Wars. So who did Star Wars, So to what you're saying, I get that Netflix needs to do more original stuff, but the thing is they have been doing that, a ton of that. They've been bringing in shows from other countries and like branding them as Netflix originals, but they've been doing their own content too. And with like some of the Marvel stuff, So I think it's a mix of things. Like, this is definitely a nostalgia play, but I think an important one, because it'll get those Gilmore Girls viewers to come back and, like, check out this new stuff. It'll also get more people in that loop of catching up.
So it's good for business for Netflix. I don't actually think the content is the same. It's not the same when you bring back a show like Arrested Development or Full House. It's never going to be the same when you bring it back. So I think in a way it's better for business for Netflix than it is for the nostalgic viewer who just wants a good show to watch.
It depends on how it's done, right? Arrested Development was kind of experimental in the way they brought it back. Didn't quite work. I know a lot of people hate that season. There's a lot to like about it.
Yeah, I mean, as a guy who was a big fan of Arrested Development, like, it was fine. It wasn't great.
It wasn't amazing, because they were trying to go for this weird nonlinear narrative thing where you could watch any episode and just, like, know the story, and they, like, did pieces of character stories throughout all the episodes. Didn't quite work, but it's all up to the writers. It's up to the creators, and they're getting, you know, Amy Sherman-Palladino back, so that's all great.
But, I mean, Arrested Development was the first of those, like, big names that they brought back, right? That was, like, the first big show they resurrected.
Yeah.
And since then, they've done it countless times. Mm-hmm.
I don't know who Fuller House was for.
I don't know who Fuller House was for either. Yeah. In preparation for today's episode, I sat down with Dana, and we were looking over the entire list of, like, resurrected or rebranded.
You know, in theory, Fuller House was for me. I used to look forward to watching Full House as a kid on Friday night, but I actually would be too embarrassed to watch it now. Not embarrassed, like, in the sense, like,
it's a terrible show.
Not embarrassed, like, I worry about what you think of me, but embarrassed, like, I cringe at bad TV and bad movies.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And but I don't like watching people embarrass themselves.
Along with doing this, Netflix is doing things like BoJack Horseman, a show which directly, like, comments on that whole, like, Full House genre and is so weird and depressing and hilarious that I don't think any other network or any, like, I can't imagine anywhere else, maybe HBO, that could run something like that.
Well, I guess, so here's my question then, is they have things like BoJack Horseman, which I haven't watched, to be honest. I know I need to.
Terrence.
I know.
That show was made for you.
I'm sure. I've heard this. But doesn't doing things like bringing back the Gilmore Girls, which is personal opinion of Gilmore Girls aside,
Have you actually seen Gilmore
Girls? I have seen every episode of the Gilmore Girls at least twice. Okay?
So you were tortured by the Gilmore Girls.
I loathe the Gilmore Girls with every fiber of my being.
So good.
It's like all of the things that I hate about Aaron Sorkin fed through a lens of, like, waspy New England women. I have no interest. It does nothing for me. But I mean,
we're gonna have a fight on the podcast right here. Like, we're going across the table.
There's a fight almost broke out in the chat room the other day over this. But doesn't doing things like this kind of water down their brand at some point? Like, Netflix is trying to make this play for being a home for, like, great original content, pulling people away from cable and all that stuff. And they're spending so much time and effort and money doing things like Degrassi, The Next Class.
No, but you know what? Like,
I love Degrassi. The Next Class is garbage.
I think that ship has sailed. I mean, Netflix, to the extent that it's a modern-day Blockbuster video store, has tons of crap on it that Netflix itself didn't produce. And also, some of the stuff it does produce is also crappy. House of Cards, I love it. I'm addicted to it. Is it still a crappy soap opera?
Yeah.
I mean,
I gave up this season.
I stopped watching it, too. The first season was very, very good.
Yes.
I loved it. The second season...
This idea that Netflix only does and airs high-quality stuff, like, that ship has sailed a long time ago.
It's more like, how long have we spent talking about Netflix on this podcast? That's why they do it.
Yeah.
It's
brand, mostly just because they want...
Get their brand out, yeah.
They want people to yell about the Gilmore Girls thing and get excited.
And also, a point I see made quite a bit, too, is when they have original series, those can go in any territory. And now that Netflix is global and all over the world, like, they don't have to pay rights to bring those shows there. So they want as much original stuff as they can, even if it's a reboot.
Fair enough. Yeah. As we established earlier, the system is rigged, and I am awarding Dana the point just because my hatred for
Gilmore
Girls.
I wish I had
Gilmore
a Bernie
Girls.
Sanders voice. I won't do a Trump voice.
But that's okay. Mm-hmm.
I'll have my Gilmore Girls, and I'll be happy.
Yeah, and you've won plenty before. I'm just scoring personal points here.
Yes.
I very rarely get to use
a few wins. I don't usually win on this
show. It's true. You do need a healthy bump so that you don't end up at the bottom of the pile for CES.
Yeah, no.
You don't want to be the one who gets tortured on stage.
No. Leave that to, like, Velasco.
Yeah. Because he'll be all for it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That man has no shame.
It's true. Hey, nothing wrong with not having shame. But now it is time to move on to our next segment in Open Sourced and dig into sort of the what goes into a lot of our coverage here. And I want to talk about Microsoft. And okay. Yesterday, Devendra, you spent some time at the big Surface event. So why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, I spent the whole day with Microsoft. A lot of stuff happening. I'll save the most exciting stuff for the end. But they announced the Windows 10 Creators Update, which is going to be coming in spring and has a couple nice changes. Paint is now going to be called Paint 3D. I think it's going to be, I don't know if it's replacing Paint, but Paint 3D is a new app, just like Paint, that'll let you create 3D objects. And they're really aiming it at kids, because a lot of kids, Microsoft Paint is one of the first things they end up playing with. You'll be able to create 3D objects, bring in stuff from Minecraft, which is pretty cool, do some edits there, and straight from there, 3D print it. So Microsoft kind of has the whole cycle of like building and creating and producing 3D printed objects. That's kind of interesting and probably the most fascinating thing about this update. Beyond that, there's going to have built-in game broadcasting too, which is kind of cool, although I think people who are doing this are already doing it on Twitch or something. There's a new sharing feature, which puts your closest contacts like in the taskbar so you can quickly like share files with them or send them messages. I'll have a longer story on that coming soon. Beyond that, Surface Book is getting some new hardware, more battery life, faster processor, faster graphics, and the Surface Studio, which is Microsoft's Surface all-in-one, which is gorgeous. It is
which
a beautiful
was
machine.
Rumored, but I think somehow managed to be surprising and impressive to you guys, even though you've kind of went in thinking you knew what you were going to see.
Yeah, we thought the rumors were like there were going to be multiple all-in-ones with some sort of like rotating display. But seeing it in person, it's a 28-inch screen, gorgeous resolution. It's like 4,500 by 3,000 pixels, so higher than 4K. And the key feature is that the screen floats down. You can kind of push it down to 20-degree angle, which is about the same as a drafting table. And seeing that in action, it's just gorgeous. And moving it yourself, like it's so easy to move. They made it so that even a 5-year-old could do it. But it also, the screen can be in any angle in between being straight up and 20 degrees. And it's pretty solid there, too. It's basically a mini PC with a giant screen, right? It has an Intel 6th-generation processor, decent NVIDIA mobile graphics, not desktop graphics. But you could plug in up to 32 gigabytes of RAM, a lot of storage, basically the ultimate computer for professionals, and starting at $3,000 too. So those are going to be the people who are going to be buying it, like MacBook or Mac Pro users, potentially.
That's not a small price tag. And I mean, they also have like a bunch of accessories and stuff too, right?
Yeah, there's so they have this new thing called the Surface Dial, which is, think of like the best audio amplifier, you know, dial that you could think of. It has a great feel to it. You could put it right on the Surface Studio screen, and it opens up other options depending on the app you're using. So in Photoshop, it'll let you actually change the color of the palette or change the size of the brush. You can kind of choose how it works. Basically, a way for you to use both of your hands at the same time to create and get in the creation zone. It's pretty cool. It's something I haven't seen before, and it'll also work with other surfaces, although not on their screens. You'll have to like keep it on the desk.
Does it also have a pen input like the...
Okay. And it has a Surface Pen, too. I think it's slightly improved, but it's basically the same as we've seen before. And also, not as exciting, there's a new wireless keyboard and mouse. I'm a big Microsoft like input device fan, so that looks cool to me. And they're going to have a Surface ergonomic natural keyboard as well, which I cannot wait to test.
Which we've already established you're a huge fan
of
those things.
Yes, so good.
I don't get it.
It feels great.
So you had fun yesterday.
Yeah.
I had fun, like as much as I could have fun, getting up early, waiting out in the cold for an hour, and getting to play with this hardware is pretty cool. I got to talk with some Microsoft folks about how they did it. This device is just really intriguing. You know, you look at it, there's only one cable coming out of it. That's the power cable. Everything else is kind of the display cables, the audio cables. They're in the hinge. Like they're actually in the hinge that's bending up and down. So it's a very clean looking device. I've never seen a desktop that looks like this. Even a Mac, it's so different from even the iMac.
And they're pitching it. It seems like Microsoft's whole big pitch now is pitching it at the people who would normally buy an iMac.
Yeah, the very high end iMacs, like the 27 inchers, or even I think the Mac Pros. And those professionals are people that Apple has honestly ignored for the past couple of years. The Mac Pro is an aging machine with old hardware. It was a cool design, but a lot of people didn't like it because it's not very upgradable. You can't do much with it. Same thing here. You can't really upgrade this, but it's a really nice, compact way. And this screen is just a new form of interaction we just haven't really seen before. Mm-hmm. Microsoft showed off a couple apps. I think the Sketchable, which is sort of like a drawing app. Another one is like a motion comics app. I forget the name of that. But anybody who's drawing, drafting, doing architecture type stuff, there's a company that builds architecture software that's been using it too. All very cool, very useful. Like, people who really want to get their hands dirty with it could be a good thing.
It's sort of funny to see us come full circle because the first mm-hmm. Surface, even before the first commercialized Surface product came out, it was that big just big Surface display.
Yeah, it was a big, like, the big coffee table. Yeah. I think it was even, wasn't it like a CRT? I don't even think it was LCD at that point.
No, it wasn't CRT. I think it was rear projection.
Yeah.
It took a while, but we finally come back to this big, expansive mm-hmm. canvas of a display mm-hmm. that people can use to...
Well, the Surface Hub is a thing that's out and being sold right now, too, and that's like...
And that's not for consumers.
$8,000, $9,000. Yeah. That's for businesses. This is more for professionals. Right. Honestly, I don't even think the Surface Studio is really for consumers, like typical consumers.
Rich, curious, early adopters, maybe.
Those people. Yeah.
But I mean, so here's the thing that's sort of interesting to me, and Robbie, one of our editors, wrote a piece about this yesterday, is like you were saying that Apple has kind of ignored this professional class for the last little bit, and they've pushed more towards targeting your average consumer. And now Microsoft has said, you know, we've owned this like productivity, this office thing for so long. Now they're making a really explicit play for like the creative types that Apple has always had cornered.
Making the play for creatives is kind of new for Microsoft, but it kind of goes down to the way Satya Nadella has been pushing the company. Like, he's been positioning Microsoft as a company for people who get things done. You know, it's a very pragmatic philosophy, but it works because, like, Microsoft products have not always been pretty, but I've always been a Windows user because I've been able to do more with it. It's always been more flexible than, like, macOS and definitely more than Linux for me. So they're kind of honing in on that philosophy, and it kind of makes sense. Like, hearing Nadella was there at the event, whatever he says, I don't know who writes his speeches. It could just be him writing it himself, but he is so inspirational in everything he says. And Microsoft is really hammering down the idea of creativity and believing in creators and makers and things like that. And it's just weird. That's stuff you'd normally hear from Apple, you know?
Do you think there's a lot of money to be made there, though, or is it purely a status play? Because I think, you know, Apple had that market cornered. They had, like, if you were a designer, if you were a writer or whatever, you used a Mac. But even with that market cornered, Apple barely survived the 90s. Yep. So for Microsoft, do they actually think there's like this big untapped market that they're going to make a ton of profit from? Or are they just like, we want to have Surface studios on TV?
It does seem more, I guess it's a bit of everything, right? It's a status thing. It shows that Microsoft can build a giant all-in-one sort of PC like this. But in some ways, it also shows the future of desktop computing too, right? You're not just staring at a monitor. You're maneuvering it so it's more flexible for you. You're, you know, painting on it with a stylus. You could do a lot more than you could with computers in the past. And the industry is just so different now. So I think there is a decent market here. But mostly it's for Microsoft to say, hey, we can do this. And the Surface has always been kind of an ideal for other PC makers. So maybe it'll push others to kind of be so creative too.
So I think this is, I don't want to call it a hobby. I think it really is a real business for Microsoft. I just don't think it's going to be their bread and butter in a way. I think Microsoft is in a similar boat as Google. You could take away both of their device businesses and they'd still be fabulously rich, big companies. But I think similar to what Devinder was saying, it's helpful for a company like Microsoft to have a flagship device that is not only a beacon for other device makers, but really puts the software in its best light. I mean, I think this is great exposure for Windows itself, even if not that many people need a Surface Studio or end up buying
one. You'll walk by it in a store and just be like, wow. And that idea is incepted in your head that Microsoft makes products that make you say, wow. So I think that's kind of the big thing. And we saw last year the Surface business overall has surpassed $1 billion for Microsoft. Mm-hmm. It's probably not making much profit, but the business is growing very quickly.
Yeah, it's done better, at least in terms of pure revenue, than I think a lot of people expected.
Mm-hmm. I mean, early on, wasn't there a quarter where they actually had to write off?
Oh, yeah. The Surface RT, it was basically almost $1 billion, like $700 to $1 billion that they had to write off.
So now that it makes any money at all is an improvement. Something. It doesn't mean it's going to pay all their bills, but they won't say no to more money.
For sure, for sure. And one thing we didn't mention in the Surface Pro 4, not changing at all. Same hardware as last year, same price as last year. That's kind of annoying to me. I've argued for a long time they should be including the keyboard in the price of the Surfaces. That's another $130 we'll be paying on top of the $899. At this point, it's a year old, just like throw that in, make that clear. Every time I talk to people at Microsoft, they keep saying the Surface is a great value. That was true last year, less true a year later.
Yeah, you know? that was one of the biggest stories actually from yesterday, which is weird that this, you know, no news is news somehow. But yeah, I was surprised that it didn't even get like a minor spec bump or a price cut or anything.
We've been saying the same thing with Apple when they failed to update the MacBook Air. I think when the Surface Pro, one of their flagship products, gets long in the tooth, you have to point that out also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's a thing of we've grown accustomed at this point to like really reliable upgrade cycles. And when all of a sudden a company skips one, even by a couple of months.
Yeah.
Everybody like loses their shit and thinks the world is coming to an end.
And I'm fine with skipping it if you kind of give us something back in return. Like maybe the people who are waiting for the Surface Pro 4 to come down in price get a deal. Yeah. Something like that. That would be nice.
I mean, not that this will likely happen, but who knows? Maybe next week Microsoft will quietly release an update to the Surface Pro 4 and just be like, we didn't feel like taking time up at the event.
I expect some decent Black Friday deals. Maybe that's what they're waiting for.
Although the chances of them updating it in the next couple of weeks are pretty much non-existent since they wasted time on the Surface Book i7, which is perhaps the worst named device Microsoft has ever released.
Yeah. Well, is it that the official name? It's just the i7 version of the Surface Book. So kind of what has already been there.
I thought that was the official name. I might be wrong on that. We might have to double check that one. But I was pretty sure that the official name was Surface Book
i7.
Which is terrible.
Yeah.
You don't want to name things after processors.
Yeah. At least 16 hours of battery life, so they claim, even with like the usual like overestimation, that if they get at least 12 hours, that's a good number for a desktop like that or laptop.
Thank
like
goodness
that.
We have a battery test that can time itself so that I don't have to sit next to it for 16 hours while I'm reviewing it.
Yes.
I'm going to throw it out there right now, though. If they successfully make a laptop that lasts 16 hours on a charge,
I will
buy it.
Yeah.
Like, without question, trade in my ThinkPad, I become a Surface guy.
Trading your ThinkPad.
That's not saying much. You've already made clear on this podcast you don't really like that thing.
Oh,
You're cursed with it.
I am cursed with it. Well, this is like really off topic, but I love my ThinkPads. I've always been a ThinkPad guy. I've had great experiences. There are things I love about this machine. I just think they made several mistakes with the keyboard.
Have you seen the ThinkPad OLED yet? We reviewed that. I'll show you that after show.
I mean,
OLED.
I don't know. I want a mechanical keyboard on my laptop.
What?
I just want to go back to like the old school ThinkPad. I'm going to break out my like whatever. I think the last one I had was the X200.
Oh, that was great. Yeah.
It still works. Mm-hmm. It's still fine. It's just the battery doesn't last anymore. Any last thoughts or anything on Microsoft before we move on?
I mean, I'm really looking forward to reviewing the Surface Studio. That's going to be fun on my desk. And I imagine a lot of AOLers will also be like, what the heck is that? That is such a strange looking computer. So
I plan on being in the office that week.
Yeah. That's what happened when I reviewed the Surface Book last year.
Yeah. And we'll have review of that at some point, too.
IT especially will come by your desk.
Yeah.
What's that?
All right, let's move on to our big topic of the week in group chat, and that is Twitter. Normally, we don't like to talk earnings on this show because earnings are boring.
Yes.
But I do think there's quite a lot to mine with Twitter right now. Their earnings came out today. It was, at best, a mixed bag. We won't bore you with the specific numbers. Also, I don't know the specific numbers off the top of my head. I don't really care.
It's the outcome that's important.
Yeah. But I guess, Devendra, why don't you just give us like a quick recap of the last like couple of months at this point.
I mean, they've been trying to get bought, and that hasn't happened. We've heard Disney was a suitor. We heard that even Salesforce was a suitor. And the Salesforce thing was interesting because they very publicly said that they were just not interested in what they were kind of selling there. And meanwhile, today, what we have is after these earnings or with these earnings, they announced that they're firing 350 employees. And that follows another firing of like what, another over 300 people.
Yeah, it was like 320 something last year.
Yeah.
Something like
that. So, not, you know, clearly they're trying to tighten their belt a little. They're still dealing with the troll problem and the abuse problem, which they can't even handle, but people are getting more and more vocal about it. So, kind of a storm on all fronts for Twitter. And that's a shame because it's still, I think, the social network I use the most.
Same here. And we should be clear that 350 and 320 something layoffs doesn't sound like a lot in the grand scheme of things, because most of the time if we're covering layoffs, we're talking layoffs in the thousands more often, because we're covering these giant companies. Twitter is not that big of a company.
It's 9% of their workforce. Yeah. So it's nearly one in 10 people will be losing their jobs.
Yeah.
It's not good.
I have friends who've worked at Twitter, and everybody is super excited when they join in. And after a while, it's just everyone says they just have no clue what they're doing. Like, there's no direction. They don't know how to manage their products in general. Yeah.
I will defend Twitter slightly on that and say that is generally the reaction I hear from most people whenever they start any job, which is they get super excited that I'm joining this company, and then 6 months in go, they have no idea what they're doing.
Everyone is terrible.
Yeah.
This is true.
So one of the things I do want to point out about these earnings, which I thought we immediately, when they announced this, I at least was like, well, this is going to be terrible.
Yeah.
Is they decided to bury their earnings and do it before markets opened, which is very rare for an American company.
7 a.m. Yeah.
Well, 7 a.m. Eastern.
Eastern,
and Twitter is a San Francisco-based company, which means it was 4 a.m. local for them. Which is basically just like setting off alarms all over the place that earnings are going to be really, really bad.
You're going to have some happy journalists up in the morning to write that too.
Yeah.
So.
Generally, the only earnings that come out at 4 a.m.
If they could have announced their earnings as the Microsoft or Apple live blog was beginning, they would have done that too.
Yeah. It's about the only way they could have been more explicit about how much they wanted to bury this news. Yeah, I mean, it's the sort of thing, not to get too inside baseball, that we, when we found out, were like scrambling. We're like, well, we expected somebody on the West Coast to cover this because that's when you do earnings releases is after the market closes.
We assign reporters to these things.
Yeah.
And then we're like, oh, but you'll be asleep now.
Yeah. It's like generally like we don't want to give it to somebody on the East Coast because we don't want to make them stay late. So we give it to the West Coast guy. And they're like, oh, well, we can't have you wake up at 3 a.m. That's just unfair.
Not great.
So yeah, I mean, it turned the entire morning into turmoil basically because of it. So thanks for that, Twitter.
Good job.
Thanks. but let's go back to this, whole purchasing thing. So they were trying to get bought. That does not appear like it's going to happen now. I mean, when even Salesforce doesn't want you.
Yeah. And honestly, that seemed like a bad fit. Salesforce had the money for it, but it seems like them and everybody else is getting scared off. Even Disney by this troll problem.
The funniest part to me was Disney belatedly waking up and saying, "Wah, this is not family friendly. There are trolls here."
I like your Muppet voice.
What?
Wah?
To be fair.
Delayed reaction on their part.
Disney has a lot of not-so-family-friendly properties.
Yeah, that's true. Like, they own Marvel, and Marvel's producing these really, really adult superhero stories on Netflix, so.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, and crazy. They have plenty of adult superhero comic books.
Yes.
See, that's less weird to me. I honestly don't know why Disney wanted Twitter in the first place, if I'm honest. It just all of the who
Blank
were the
source,
other who were the other potential suitors? We had Disney, we had Apple, Salesforce, Apple,
Google. Anybody who has enough money to buy a company like Twitter.
That was basically it. That was like the only qualifier. Nobody thought about what they were going to do with it probably. They were just like, can we afford it?
Well, that's how, I mean, I used to cover like startups and business deals more. And that's kind of how a lot of these companies think, right? Oh, this company is growing. We just get to buy them. Like, who knows what we'll do with them? That was the thing when Facebook bought Instagram. Nobody knew what Facebook was going to do with Instagram. But Zuckerberg was like, hey, this is growing faster than our photos thing. So we get to buy this. And setting off a new standard in terms of like how much people would spend on a startup too. So yeah, it seems like rarely is there a strategy to buying a thing like this.
So I mean, what if no one buys it. So it's a public company, right? It's still yep. beholden to investors. And if they're not making money and they're losing all this money, it's a problem. My instinct still is we need Twitter. You can't just close down Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, if Twitter goes away, that's going to be a really sad day for
someone me. Has to save Twitter.
Somebody has to. The thing is, Twitter should be able to save itself, and it's just sad that it hasn't. I think in an ideal world, it would be its own independent thing, too. Honestly, it seems like something that should at some point just be like another internet service, right? Twitter, to me, is as useful as email or something like that. Like, I would love for it to go open completely in that sort of way, but we'll probably never see that. Yeah.
Well, what do you think the value is in Twitter becoming like an open communications protocol?
Monetarily, probably not much. But the thing is, when you create things like that, and we don't do that much anymore, right? Email was created, a lot of the earlier standards, when they were building up the web, that was about building a community and creating something that everybody would use. That, that's here now already. So how do you go about creating something open like that? I don't think you can do that today. Like, the internet is all about people buying property and real estate now. Yeah.
Well, I guess that was sort of the point I was trying to make. Is you say, you'd like to see it become this, open thing, but nobody does that?
Even, it's impossible.
Yeah, it's just never going to work, probably. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm trying to think of the most recent example of something like that I've seen. I guess, the best example I can think of is Jabber, probably.
Yeah.
They tried to build this open source instant messaging platform so that everybody can use it. GChat was built on Jabber so that you could use it across all these platforms and make it easy.
It just got absorbed.
Yeah, and just eventually they realized this is too limited, this isn't going to work, this isn't what people want, and they shut it down. I don't even know what Jabber does anymore. Is that even a thing?
Yeah. It's not, I don't know. So my dream for Twitter would be like this pure open thing. Sort of like the way I saw Twitter early on, my first interactions with Twitter was just like, oh, it's sort of like in the Matrix, right? When they start to see the like weird code just falling down the screen, it's like, oh, I see how the world is built now. And Twitter is sort of like that stream of information, like at its best, you see what's going on everywhere. I would love for them to really double down on that. But right now it's just kind of, I know there's so many other problems they have to deal with.
Yeah. And I mean, the biggest problem is obviously, we mentioned it passing before, the troll problem. They did say today that they have plans to do like meaningful, in quotes, safety updates, but they didn't offer a lot of detail. I'm kind of wondering like what to expect. Like, does anybody have an idea how to fix this? Because I think it's clear Twitter doesn't.
Well, there have been so many reports too about how endemic the problem is for Twitter, because they don't know how to deal with harassment. They've honestly like have ignored it, because some of those users do help their numbers, right? They help with engagement on the service. They give higher numbers of engagement and of users and whatnot. And if Twitter starts to take those numbers away, they look less valuable as a company too. So it's a shame. It's a shame that they've valued that more than protecting their users. Now things like the problems are getting more public. You have Leslie Jones talking about her issues with the service and everything. There was her SNL skit last week, I think. They can't ignore it anymore.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So any last thoughts on what Twitter needs to do next?
Probably laying off people is the best thing they could do to kind of like stay afloat and do their thing. But they got to refocus
in terms of their business model.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know.
You don't know.
I think so many of us have ideas for the product, but not how they should make money.
Yeah.
Which makes sense, right?
Yeah. Which is why
we're product users and not journalists.
We don't
critiquers of product. We're
it's
not
just weird
business
how
people.
Everything they do has started to fail, right? They hired a head of diversity who was just like a white dude trying to handle diversity. They hired I believe it was them. They tried to hire a VR guy, right? And that was problematic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was fired. Wasn't he gone like within 24 hours?
Yes, because TechCrunch wrote a story because he had this whole thing. He had like a railing post against homeless people in San Francisco that really sound like an elitist thing against these degenerates. They can't do anything right.
No, they can't. And I almost feel bad because it's not like Snapchat, where I feel like the people who run Snapchat are actively malicious people.
Mm-hmm.
I think like they're bad humans. Hi, guys. I feel like Twitter just can't help but get in its own way. Like, it's just like, it's again, like the diversity, head of diversity thing. Like, that was a really easy one to knock out of the park.
No. Nope.
How did you screw that up? Like, and I don't think it was a malicious thing. I think they were honestly trying to do the right thing. They just don't know what they're doing.
They don't know what to do. Well, the thing is, too, it's like Jack Dorsey is back in charge and leading Twitter. I think that guy has modeled himself on Steve Jobs in so many ways, like straight down to his behaviors and the way he's starting to act. But he doesn't have the substance beneath. Like, he doesn't have that kernel of like ingenuity or vision or anything. Yeah.
We are out of time, though. So if the people out there want to continue this conversation about how Twitter is falling apart and how Snapchat is the worst and all that, hit us up on Twitter or email. Devendra, where can the fine people find you?
I'm at Devendra on Twitter. Yes.
Not going to plug your other show today?
I review movies at slashfilm.com. We've had a bad run of movies to review lately, so it's been rough.
You don't want to encourage
it. It's been rough. I did see Arrival, so that review is going to be a lot of fun.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dana, where can the fine people find you?
I am at Dana Wallman on Twitter. It's my full name with no space.
Okay.
Yep.
I am at Terrence O'Brien, lots of E's, no A's. You can also hit us up at Engadget Podcast on Twitter, or you can email us podcast@engadget.com. Send us your thoughts, comments, questions, all of that stuff. We want to hear what you think. Also, don't forget to subscribe in iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Rate us on there. The more ratings we get, the more people can find us, and the more people can hear our lovely voices and all of the things that we think, because we're important enough to have a show.
Yeah.
But thank you for watching and listening. Don't forget to tune in next week. But before we go, I want to leave you with the comment of the week, which comes from Gallius. Gandalf for president.
Sure.
The gray or the white?
He didn't specify. I'm sorry.
Damn it, Gallius.